Good morning, everybody. Austin is away today. This is Tony Beam, Director of Church and Community Engagement for the Tim Brazier Campus of North Greenville University, where Christ makes the difference and where we are equipping transformational leaders for the church and society. Good morning. It's a Friday. It's back patting day. Pat yourself on the back if you had to work this week, which some people did, some people haven't. If you're teaching school in Greenville County, you've pretty much been out all week. Anderson County, I think, went to school yesterday and then canceled school for today because they thought it was going to snow again. And, of course, there's no snow on the ground outside if you're – I mean, at least there isn't any in Greer, and there wasn't any between Greer and Greenville. I don't know what is going on somewhere else. It's 34 degrees. If it snows, it's going to melt. So there goes the big storm that we're going to get this weekend that everybody was buying milk for again. So, you know, we need some kind of law. We need a law to protect milk in South Carolina. The assault on milk and bread has got to stop because milk and bread is suffering. And I'm suffering because I can't get my milk and bread. Of course, I really don't care about milk. If my milk's not chocolate, I don't drink it.
That's right.
So bread, that. You know, bread, I do have this affinity for bread. You bring me bread. Bread, you bring me bread. What is that? Oh, that's an old Gilligan's Island thing. Okay. Where these things come from in the deep folds of my brain, sometimes I have no idea. And I try not to think about it because it's kind of scary. This is the weekend of Roe versus Wade. Law was passed or upheld by the United States Supreme Court 7-2 in 1973. Tomorrow will be the anniversary. And so the big pro-life march in Washington takes place tomorrow. Generally, I find myself in D.C. when we're having this event, but I didn't get to go this year. Just too many things that made it impossible for me to get up there. But they will have the march tomorrow, and it's going to be, you know, it's really going to be an interesting year to be in Washington for the Roe versus Wade, the pro-life, national pro-life march. And when I call it Roe versus Wade, I'm talking about, of course, it's held to call attention to the fact that in the United States, we think it's perfectly fine to kill a baby in the womb, which a lot of countries don't do this. Particularly, I mean, countries have much more strict abortion laws than the United States because we've convinced ourselves that this is about a woman's body, not about the baby's body that's being developed inside the woman. So the whole nature of the argument has been turned on its head from the beginning. A woman's right to privacy is somehow a sacred right that supersedes a baby's right to life. That's never made any sense. It doesn't make sense today, 49 years after Roe has been decided. So Supreme Court is sitting on a decision. We won't find out until June, but there has been some action on this. Let's see if we can get my, yeah, here we go. This is coming from the Wall Street Journal. The Supreme Court allowed Texas' six-week abortion ban to remain in effect indefinitely, issuing an order on Thursday, that would have been yesterday, blocking litigation against the law while the state's highest court weighs a procedural question related to the measure's enforcement. So basically what this means is that abortion advocates, pro-death advocates, were asking the Supreme Court to instruct the Fifth Circuit to send this thing back to the Supreme Court in Texas. And the Supreme Court declined to do that. So this is going to sit there. This is going to, and I really think all of this is tied very tightly to the Mississippi law, to Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health. You know, of course, the Supreme Court heard arguments at the end of last year on this case, oral arguments, and the decision, while it may have already been made, we don't know. Sometimes these decisions get made. Sometimes they don't get made until the spring. But and whatever, we're not going to find out the outcome until June. And so everybody's just kind of waiting for June. I think the Supreme Court is saying this Texas law is going to stay in effect until June. Now, there are other procedural moves on the law that will be made in Texas but most of those are going to be put in abeyance until the Supreme Court makes its pronouncement. And nobody knows what's going to happen. I mean, I'm you know, when you hear these arguments and you hear what the justices ask and you kind of see their attitude or sense what their thinking might be, that's perfectly fine as long as we put in the caveat that all of the real discussion about this is taking place with the doors shut, not with the court occupied. That's public show. And it's fine. It's traditional. We need it. Arguments should be made. The case before the court should be in front of everybody that it's going to affect. And that's always everybody because it affects the law. So I absolutely believe that that's the case. But I'm just reminding you that that's the tip of the proverbial iceberg, because all kind of discussion is taking place in the halls of the Supreme Court. All kinds of legal maneuvering and investigation and looking at precedent and aides running to and fro, bringing stacks of documents to justices who are going to use them to either support or their position or to attack the other position. All of that stuff is going on, and we don't ever see it. We don't really know what happened with Obamacare. We just know that somewhere along the way, Chief Justice John Roberts decided to call the Obamacare penalty a tax, and magically, just poof, it becomes constitutional. Poof, it's constitutional. It's like giving Roberts some kind of, Harry Potter power here. Or maybe even like if you're older like me, it's like being able to wiggle your nose like Samantha on Bewitched and just get what you want just by speaking it into existence or snapping your fingers or something. Or if you're Q off of, you know, Star Trek, The Next Generation, you just do this little thing with your hand and boom, something that's a penalty becomes a tax. That's essentially what Roberts did. And we don't know for sure what happened behind those closed doors that led to Roberts' transformation. But it was a 5-4 decision to dump Obamacare, and then the penalty became a tax. So that's why, I think it's a fool's errand for everybody to jump up and down and say Republicans rule after November, it's a fool's errand at this point to say what the Supreme Court's going to do with any kind of certainty. If you want to speculate, speculate in humility, not in hubris, because if you get pretty doggedly sure about something, you can be doggedly sure that you're probably going to be wrong. So in any event, right now, all of these, the big story from yesterday, here's the takeaway. The Supreme Court is not interested in limiting the Texas law until they decide on the Dobbs case, or if they've already decided, until they release their decision. So for now, in the state of Texas, you're not going to be able to get an abortion past 6 weeks, because that's when a heartbeat is detected. And if you do so, you do so at the peril of being fined $10,000 and being sued by a private citizen. Now, we can debate the merits of that law. Some say it's insane because it'll be used in a lot of different ways that we would not like. Pro-lifers, we like the fact that right now there are not a whole lot of abortions taking place in Texas. But when you think about the nature of that law and the fact that you could set it up, and Newsom in California is talking about using it to limit gun manufacturing and to limit guns, period, to allow citizens to get a law passed that will allow citizens to enforce the law by suing gun manufacturers or gun providers or whatever. And so if this becomes some type of precedent, then what we're celebrating today could be our worst nightmare. Now, I'm not saying that's going to happen. I don't think this law is going to, in Texas, is going to survive much past Dobbs. Whatever Dobbs defines, states will begin then to conform to whatever this new standard is. There have been like 6 or 7 states that have introduced Texas-like laws to ban abortion, And, of course, we haven't done that in South Carolina, but we do have
the heartbeat law.
Well, we do have the heartbeat bill, but it's not based on private enforcement. It doesn't allow private citizens to file a lawsuit. And when I talk to lawmakers about this, people that are our allies in the South Carolina House and Senate, they don't want to get anywhere near this. They want to – everybody's – what's going to happen is a wait and see. Now, we may get a minor bill out that has something to do with informed consent when it comes to the abortion reversal pill and so forth. I mean, that whether that's going to pass or not, what we should be doing is passing a total ban on chemical abortions in South Carolina. That's what states that have a clear, philosophically conservative majority are doing. Just like in Florida. In Florida, the Senate is moving forward legislation to ban critical race theory and other types of misleading educational tools, to ban that in their in businesses where it can't be taught in seminars at businesses or in schools. And they're just doing it because down in Florida, you have people in the Senate who are principled, philosophical conservatives, and I don't know what we have in South Carolina. We've got some good lawmakers down there that are doing their best to try to keep South Carolina in the conservative camp and to pass philosophically conservative legislation. But we just don't have enough of them to get a lot of that stuff done. Yes, we passed a heartbeat bill. Yes, we did. But it's almost like, okay, we've done this, so now we don't have to do anything else. You know, when it comes to social conservatism, we're not going to lean into the transgender issue, which there's news on that front today, which is just it's just ridiculous and muddying, but we'll get to it in a few minutes. All right, the fallout continues over President Biden's disastrous press conference that he held 2 days ago. And I thought we'd spend this segment talking a little bit about it because we're not going to spend a whole lot of time today because we went through that pretty thoroughly yesterday. But I think it's interesting to note the continuing response of the Biden administration to the fallout that he created, because over 2 hours of a rambling, sometimes incoherent, often disjointed press conference where there had to be a lot of cleanup on aisle 5 after the thing was over. They're trying to decide what to do. And the decision that apparently they have made is interesting. I love Ben Shapiro's comment yesterday. He called Jen Psaki, who's the press secretary for the president, the night nurse for Joe Biden, which, you know, you the night nurse comes in and generally cleans up and tries to put things in order. I think that's a pretty good title for her. And I guess if she's the night nurse, then Kamala Harris is the day nurse, because those two have been dispatched to various media outlets to try to put an interpretation and positive spin on the president's press conference. The problem is you can't do it. In order to make something sound better than it is, you have to have enough original material to work with. And if you don't have enough original material, going out and trying to make something sound good that is vacuous, that there's really no material there to shape or form, it really is like sitting down at a potter's wheel with an ounce of clay and you're wanting to make a representation of the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. I mean, you just can't, there's just not enough stuff there. You can't take what you've been given when you're given so little and trying to spin it into something that is palatable for the American people. And this is the problem. This is the challenge. You know, instead of looking at their policies, which are garbage policies, that's the problem with the Biden administration. The overall problem is that America put one guy in office and they got a completely different guy. This is not Biden 2.0. This is Biden 5.0. We're generations away, in so to speak, in the difference between the candidate and the actual president of the United States. He ran as a placeholder. At one point during the campaign, he admitted that basically he was just, you know, just think of old Joe as not doing any harm. Well, old Joe has done a ton of harm. Just ask the people of Afghanistan. Just ask the people who are going to the grocery store every day and paying 7% more at the grocery store and at the pump and everywhere else because of inflation. Just talk to the people who are trying to, in the construction business or in the microchip business or any business that relies heavily on the efficiency of our supply chain, and you'll find a great harm that's been done by Joe Biden, by President Biden and his administration. So they got to try to spin this. So they've decided, you know, it's not our policies that the American people don't like. We don't have a policy problem. We have a communication problem. It's a PR problem. It's not policy, it's PR. We've just got to get out there and do a better job of communicating what we're saying. Because if the American people could just clearly understand, they certainly can't clearly understand the president, because nobody can do that at this point. The president doesn't even know for sure what he's talking about. So if we can just take what the president is trying to say in his two-hour press conference and roll that out to the American people and get the right people talking about it, the sun's going to come out, the policies are going to start flowing through Congress, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema are going to see the light, and it's going to be a great day in D.C. That's not going to work, because to start with, I know Bill Clinton, Mr. President, and you're no Bill Clinton. If I could borrow that line, you know, that was used against Dan Quayle, what was in the 1992, leading up to the 92 election, the vice presidential debate, you had Lloyd Benson pull that line on Dan Quayle. That was either the re-election or during the election. It might have been during the election cycle when Bush overcame that, because he didn't have Ross Perot out there taking 20% of the vote. But in any event, Lloyd Benson used that line against Dan Quayle when Dan Quayle tried to present himself as Jack Kennedy. And if Joe Biden thinks he can present himself as Bill Clinton, you know, Bill Clinton was an emotional creature. He was an emotive guy. He was somebody who could communicate in a lot of different ways, a lot of different styles. I mean, he could get emotional, he could get angry, he could get, he could sound prideful, he could sound humble. Whatever the communication requirement was at the moment for him to get his message across, Bill Clinton could do that. Joe Biden can't do it. He can't. He's not capable. He's got one mode, and it's monotone, stop for long pauses in between sentences to figure out where he's going next, clutch his document. Did you see during the press conference when there were points when I thought he was going to crumple up everything that he had in his hands just by the way he was clutching this stuff? I mean, it was pathetic. So what is the strategy? All right, we send Jen Psaki over here to Fox News. We send Kamala Harris over to the Today Show, which was an absolute disaster because she gets into a back and forth fight because she's actually facing some tough questions from Guthrie. And Guthrie's not backing down. I mean, to her credit, this is what the press is supposed to do. They're supposed to ask political leaders of both parties, of the major parties, tough questions and force them to defend their positions to the American people and to do it in a way that's persuasive if you're going to win the debate in Washington. So what do? If Joe Biden has got an approval rating of 38, 39, I think the composite, if you put them all together, the aggregate of the poll, maybe 42%, 43, he's way underwater in his approval rating. Whichever poll you look at, you don't find one where his approval rating's above 50%. It's all sub 50. And so what do? you send out somebody that's less popular than you are. You send out, you know that your presidency is in trouble if it's going to revolve around the communication skills of Kamala Harris. This is a woman who could not get any traction to get the nomination for her party to be president of the United States. She got selected to be vice president of the United States because she is a black female and she was readily available. So she's out there trying to make arguments and she's not very good at it. She's not likable. I mean, I wish politics didn't revolve around likability, but we live in a day that this started back in 1960 with Nixon, Kennedy. I mean, once candidates got on television, whether you liked them or not became a factor, much more of a factor than it did before because the exposure to the candidates was limited. Now it's unlimited. You got somebody like Kamala Harris out there. She's going to become your spokesperson. Write that agenda off, ladies and gentlemen. She can't carry the water any more than Joe Biden for different reasons. I mean, Joe Biden can't carry the water because his tank is empty. Kamala Harris can't carry the water because the water's polluted. She doesn't know how to do it. She's not a good communicator. She's not likable, and she doesn't come across well. And that was evident in that Today Show interview. It was a disaster. Now, Jen Psaki's much better at this. But again, her problem is not her lack of ability to communicate. I actually push back against the critics who say that Jen Psaki has been a terrible White House spokesperson. I think given the conditions that she's been handed, she's done as good a job as anybody could do. In fact, much better than most, considering what she's having to deal with. Now, that doesn't make me a fan. Please don't send me hate mail telling me, oh, you're just a closet Biden supporter because you don't, you're Jen Psaki's over there. Look, all I'm saying is that she goes out there and tries to defend the indefensible. And she does that about as well as anybody could be expected. She goes on Fox News. Her problem is not she can't communicate. Her problem is she doesn't have anything to offer because communication, if communication was the problem, Jen Psaki might be able to help fix it. They might find a communicator that could go out there and be a spokesperson for the left that could help these policies with a little, a little bit of sugar, a spoonful of sugar, might be able to make that medicine go down, as Mary Poppins would say. But they can't do it. You could have a 5-ton bag of Dixie Crystal, and you can't make this any more palatable because the policies are that bad. And so I just don't think this is going to work until the left wing of the Democrat Party wakes up and understands that they are in the process of dismantling. And by the way, somebody that I oppose and disagree with, when they're self-destructing, it's the best thing for me to do is get out of the way and make sure nothing hits me as the pieces start flying. But I'm saying if they want to fix it, maybe I better whisper this part. They need to look at the policies. That's what people don't want. No matter how you say it, the American people don't want the federal government to take over voting. No matter how you say it, the American people don't want 7% inflation. They don't want any more spending. They want the federal government to rein itself in, get out of the way, get out of their life, make the supply chain run, and then leave them alone. And there's nowhere in the progressive Democrat agenda that that's on the table or even being discussed. You know, I'm really tempted just to turn Boston on and just play Boston for the rest of the show. Actually, I guess what we should do is play Meatloaf for the rest of the show. If you haven't heard, Meatloaf passed away at the age of 74. According to reports, he was surrounded by his family and friends had been in the last couple of days. He suffered from a heart condition. I can't remember the name. It's some type of syndrome. that would cause him periodically to collapse on stage. He was advised by his doctors to cut back his concert schedule. He's had to walk off in the middle of a concert before. He had vocal problems, had a cyst on his vocal cords that was removed. And he did get his voice back pretty much, so he's able to do the concerts again. But just multiple health problems, evidently, at 74 was too much for him to overcome. There's not been an official cause of death released, but he did pass away. You realize he sold 100 million albums worldwide, this guy. Okay? I mean, here's a guy who just decided.
And I only remember one.
I know. Well, 2 out of 3 ain't bad.
It's on the same album.
Yeah, I know. Then you've got on a different album is, okay, what's the name of it?
I Would Do Anything for Love. That was
Yeah,
on the same
I Would Do
album.
Anything for Love. No, it wasn't. It was on the original Paradise by the Dashboard Light.
Same album.
No, Gary, it's not. They had.
I owned the album.
I know you did. So did I. But I'm telling you, it's easy to get them confused because he had a couple of hits. He did Paradise by the Dashboard Light. It sold 40 million albums. It's one of the top 10 top-selling albums in history. Mm-hmm. Then he comes back with a couple of albums that do pretty good in Great Britain, but not so hot in the United States and not worldwide. And it was because of his collaboration with this guy, what, Finnegan?
Jim Steinman.
Steinman. Okay, I'm sorry, Steinman. Jim Steinman. He goes, you know, Steinman writes all the stuff for him.
Right.
But now, reportedly, Meatloaf would work with Steinman on some of the stuff, and so it was a collaboration. But the lion's share of the writing fell to Steinman. And when they fell out, those albums were stinkers. And then when they would make up, they'd come out and have an album that would prosper.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say Bat Out of Hell was the one. And then part two, they released after the slide, then came Bat Out of Hell part two in the mid-90s that kind of revived his career, got him back on the concert circuit. He actually declared bankruptcy at one point. And, you look, and I apologize for people if you're offended that I'm calling out these album titles. I'm just telling you what they are. So, in any event, he was by every measure that you can measure success in terms of selling albums and concert touring. He was a success. 100 million albums that puts you in a fairly elite club. But bottom line, he passed away yesterday at age 74. And what's interesting is he had a lot of problems with health. He had a lot of problems. He got involved with drugs and alcohol, like most of these guys do. I think it was cocaine that was the big problem for him. He got off that. He got clean. But when he would go home, I mean, he was married to the same woman for pretty much his entire life and had a couple of daughters, and was a family man. I mean, he never smoked. It's really interesting because he was considered to be by a lot of the rock and roll circuit to be a recluse, and yet it wasn't anything to do with his personality. He was genuinely a family guy. I mean, he wanted to go do his rock and roll stuff and then go home and be with his family. And when he passed away, he was surrounded by him. So that's a good thing. All right. Back to this news conference. Actually, we're talking about the communication effort to try to clean up on aisle 5. Let me play a little bit of this Savannah Guthrie Kamala Harris exchange. This one is essentially where Biden said, "Well, a minor incursion into the Ukraine, you know, that might be something that we'd have a long discussion about. But if Russia makes a major move into the Ukraine, then the sanctions are going to fall." Well, that's caused a lot of memes. I mean, you've got Adolf Hitler going into Poland. That's being called a minor incursion. You know, the president of Ukraine said there's no such thing as a minor incursion into a small country, into a country like the Ukraine, when a country like Russia makes it. So a lot of response to this. Here's the back and forth between Kamala Harris and Savannah Guthrie from the Today Show. Here it is.
Ukrainian officials reportedly heard these words from President Biden with alarm. I know the White House tried to clarify it and clean it up afterwards, but was the damage done? You can't unring the bell. Is Vladimir Putin likely to listen to a later statement from the White House press secretary or the words of President Biden?
I will repeat myself. And I'm Vice President of the United States, and the President and I work closely together. And
let me just jump in here for a second. This is why people do not like her. She's looking at the camera. She looks like the sanctimonious person that she sounds like here, if you can just imagine her face. Let me repeat myself, Savannah. You're an ignorant. This is almost like Jane Curtin. Remember the old Saturday Night Live stuff, and you'd have Jane Curtin giving the point, counterpoint, or whatever, and Dan Aykroyd would look out, Jane, you ignorant slut. I mean, this is the look that you're getting from Kamala Harris here on the Today Show, answering a question. And if you have to tell people that you're the Vice President of the United States, it's over. I mean, when you have to look at the camera with this expression on your face and say, I'm the Vice President of the United States, I work closely with the President. Yeah, we got that. I mean, we may not be civics geniuses in this country. We may not be majors in governmental affairs, but I think we remember something about you being elected Vice President. If you got to tell people that, then you probably have no authority in your office. All right, here we go.
No, his position, because he has been consistent in that regard. If Vladimir Putin and Russia takes aggressive action, it will be met with a cost that will be severe.
Okay, but that's not what the president said in the press conference. That's what she's saying now. And if there was no ambiguous nature to the president's statements, it wouldn't be necessary for Kamala Harris to be talking to Savannah Guthrie in this manner and answering these questions. Because if the president had simply stuck to the original statement, but he did not. He equivocated. And when you're president of the United States, that matters. Now, I understand. Look, let's step back for a second. I understand what he was saying. I mean, what he was trying to communicate was, well, you know, if they just kind of shoot over the border, if they fire rockets into Ukraine, but they don't actually move in troops, or if they just move into one area and then they stop and it's not a full-blown invasion, then we're going to have arguments about that. Our allies are going to be less solid. NATO is going to be less focused on the threat, and therefore there might be some people who waffle on this. But if they do an all-out invasion, everybody's going to stay on the same page, and all these sanctions are going to fall on them like a ton of bricks. I actually understand that. I do, because in the world of geopolitics, the action taken by one nation, the idea is you don't react at a higher level than the action taken by the offending country. And a lot of our allies believe that. Now, I actually think if Vladimir Putin steps one foot over the border, that whatever the consequences are, they should be unleashed immediately and with full force. And that's essentially what the president had said up to that point. And then he gets philosophical. He just said, well, you know, the way this stuff works, he's the president of the United States. Just like Kamala Harris had to tell us that she's the vice president, Joe Biden needs to remember that he's the president. And when he speaks in a way that is different in any way than the policy he has established up to that point, it's going to cause ripples. And being consistent and staying on message is one of the important parts of good leadership in the White House. One of the reasons that you want to have a tough chief of staff is, you know, I told you, I've listened to this book that goes through the history of the office of chief of staff and how many people have held that office since Eisenhower and how it got elevated after Eisenhower, primarily by Nixon, not so much by Kennedy, but certainly by the time Nixon came along, the office of chief of staff was elevated from a glorified executive secretary to the president to the gatekeeper. I mean, somebody that has a lot of power in Washington to keep the president's staff together on message and to be the person who determines who has access to the president and how the president communicates, all of that. You got to have a tough person if you're going to have a consistent message and keep everybody together. The president doesn't have this because he doesn't have the discipline or the ability. And in a lot of ways, he's like Donald Trump in this. Now, please. I'm not saying that Joe Biden and Donald Trump. I'm saying that sometimes the way they communicate are inaccurate, and that causes them problems. For Joe Biden, I think it's a mental issue. For Donald Trump, I think it's he's not very accurate in the wording that he uses, and he doesn't care about that stuff. I mean, he just gets out there and speaks. But both of those cause issues for the office of the president when you are the president and everything you say carries the weight of the leader of the free world. All right, I'm looking at Paradise by the Dashboard Light. I'm looking at the first album, and here there are 7 songs on that album, and I Can Do Anything for Love is
not one
of
on there. You're okay. Right. You're absolutely correct. I remember
trying
when it
to
came
establish.
Out the other.
I know
my brain wasn't working all
well.
That well.
Well, that's. I won't speak of that.
That's with the theme of the whole hour.
Okay, 3 Supreme Court cases that we need to pay attention to, and let me give them to you quickly because we don't have a lot of time here. We mentioned this one yesterday briefly, but I'm going to go back to it because I'm astounded. I am with Gorsuch on this, that the Supreme Court should have taken a case called New Life in Christ Church versus City of Fredericksburg. Now, we spent a considerable amount of time on this program talking about it, but here's the essence of it. New Life in Christ Church designated their missionaries to college students as ministers. And they said this is perfectly consistent with our particular denomination, which is PCA, Presbyterian Church in America. This is consistent with the way that we designate ministers. And so they said they're ministers living in this house that's being provided. We should not have to pay taxes. They shouldn't have to pay taxes on the house because they fall under a ministerial exemption. The city of Fredericksburg said, we don't care what the Presbyterian Church in America says is a minister. We're telling you what we believe is a minister according to your own documents. So I want you to think now, the reason I got so agitated about this is not because, is it a minor issue? Well, in the broad scope of religious liberty, if you're looking specifically at this one instance of 2 ministers in a house in Fredericksburg, yes, it's a minor issue. But if you're looking at it, if you step back and you look at this thing as a government agency, a government entity, being able to tell a church how it has to define its ministerial requirements over the church's own explanation. How can a government, if we're going to have separation of church and state, then certainly the state can't tell the church what its requirements are for ministry. And that's what the city of Fredericksburg did. And the Supreme Court refused to hear it. And Neil Gorsuch about had a coronary. He took exception to the nation's high court denying the appeal in a written dissent, arguing that the Storms, which is the couple, the 2 that we're talking about here, should have been eligible for the tax-exempt residence. Quote, the church tried to explain that the city misunderstood its traditions and practices. The church responded that, yes, women can and do serve as ministers. It acknowledged that in order to deliver sermons, a minister in his tradition must be ordained, but nothing in its rules or the Book of Church Order prohibits a particular church from hiring ministers to serve as messengers and teachers of the faith without ordination. Gorsuch ended up by saying, I would grant the petition and summarily reverse. The First Amendment does not permit bureaucrats or judges to subject religious beliefs to verification. About this, the court has spoken plainly and consistently for many years. The good news is that that's true. There's a lot of precedent that would say the Supreme Court should have heard this. And the bad news is they didn't hear it. And I don't understand. I'm with Gorsuch. This is not going to go away. This is going to come up again. All right. U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments on Tuesday on whether Boston city officials wrongfully denied a request to fly the Christian flag at City Hall. The nation's high court, this is according to Christian Post, the nation's high court heard arguments in the case of Harold Shurtleff, versus Boston M.A., with the justices expressing skepticism of the arguments on both sides. Shurtleff runs an organization called Camp Constitution that exists to enhance understanding of our Judeo-Christian moral heritage and runs Constitution Day and Citizenship Day events at City Hall. Shurtleff's request to fly the Christian flag that features a cross outside of City Hall on Constitution Day in 2017 was denied based on a policy that gives the city discretion on which flags it can fly on the City Hall flagpoles. Now, so far, you've got the city with the discretion to make a decision. This is what the story is saying, that the city can decide which flags to allow and which flags to not allow. And if it says that, if the ordinance that the city passed or the way that it's set up supports that, then the city can make those decisions. The problem is they can't have a policy that arbitrarily denies religious expression to one group, particularly if they allow religious expression of any group. And then, plus, we're running out of time, so we're going to have to hold this over to the next hour. But the other part of this that's interesting is that this actually doesn't even it doesn't even violate the city's policy, because the flagpole, when they put it up, they said, this pole we designate as an instrument of public expression, and any public expression flown on this flagpole is going to be allowed. And by saying that, they can't then step in when it turns out that it's a Christian that wants to do this, when they've allowed every other expression that you can imagine to be hoisted up that pole.